Hi, this is Mike with the Talking Information Center, and today we'll be reading the Boston Sun, dated Friday, December 19th, 2025. For our first story, Route 55 service won't be extended for now due to bus repairs. This story is written by Dan Murphy. The desired implementation of extended service on the MBTA's Route 55 won't come to pass this month, as buses are now being taken out of service for maintenance. The T suspended service on the 55 bus route after the pandemic struck, and when service on the line was later restored in June of 2021, its daily hours were reduced to 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., from the previous hours of 6 a.m. to 11 p.m. The last stop on the line was also changed, then to Copley Square from Park Street. As a component of the T's ongoing bus network redesign program, the 55 line has been under consideration to have seen its hours of operation and service expanded, including during weekday peak hours, while also connecting the West Fenway neighborhood to Copley Station. The first phase of the bus network redesign changes began in December of 2024, with work in Chelsea, Everett, Revere, Malden, Somerville, Cambridge, and East Boston. A fall rollout of the program was then implemented on August 24th, which again didn't include changes to the Route 55 service. Meanwhile, buses are being removed from service for ongoing maintenance at the garage at the MBTA's Cabot Yard on Dorchester Avenue. When this extensive work has been completed and its bus fleet returns to capacity, the T will then consider to make further service changes. And those service changes will be via its bus network redesign program in 2026. Improving bus service and connectivity continues to be a major priority of the MBTA, wrote MBTA spokesperson Lisa Battison in an email. She went on to say, ample evaluation of ridership data and considerations such as equity play a role in bus route changes. Keeping the entire system in mind, we aim to create an even more robust network and are consistently looking at ways to increase service. Battiston added, quote, we do expect to have more fleet capacity when vehicle overhauls are completed. Future bus improvements continue to be planned and will be implemented during the MBTA's quarterly seasonal schedule adjustments as bus operators and supporting infrastructure are available and ready. On October 2nd, the 55 Bus Route Coalition, which the nonprofit Fenway Forward coordinates, spearheaded a well-attended community demonstration to lobby for extended hours on the Route 55 line. Nearly 30 participants joined the rally, which started with a 55 bus ride from Queensbury Street at Jersey Street to St. James Avenue at Arlington Street and concluded at the MBTA headquarters at 10 Park Plaza. Along with Fenway residents and bus riders, others in attendance included Fenway Forward organizers, Senator Lydia Edwards and Representative Jay Livingstone, as well as representatives from the offices of other elected officials, including District 8 City Councilor Sharon Durkin and City Councilor at Large Henry Santana. Moreover, the coalition's petition in support of getting longer hours implemented immediately on the 55 bus line has garnered nearly 70 signatures to date. That petition is online. Regarding the present uncertainty surrounding future expansion of hours and service on the Route 55 line, Jamie Culbertson, a Fenway Forward organizer who facilitates the 55 Bus Route Coalition, wrote, quote, it's frustrating to hear about this additional delay after Fenway residents have been waiting so long for the promised 6 a.m. to 7 p.m. hours. I hope the MBTA will prioritize extending the hours of this vital cross-neighborhood transportation link as soon as possible. To learn more about the 55 Bus Route Coalition, you can email Jamie Culbertson at jculbertson@fenwayforward.org. And for our next story, is rideshare driving too dangerous? Boston attack reignites safety debate. This story written by Ariel Appleby. After a passenger looped a wire around an Uber driver's neck and clinched it tight last month, police say the woman broke free and bolted from her car, screaming as she burst into the closest store in sight, pleading for someone to call 911. While sitting at a red light at the intersection of Massachusetts Avenue and Columbus Avenue in Boston's South End, police say Christopher Dawkins, 24, of Dorchester, looped a wire around an Uber driver's neck and strangled her, and then stole her car after she escaped. Dawkins pleaded not guilty during his arraignment on carjacking, strangulation, assault and battery with a dangerous weapon, and the larceny of a motor vehicle. Those charges in Boston Municipal Court on November 27th. He was ordered to be held without bail. For rideshare drivers, especially women and people of color, attacks are an occupational hazard they live with every shift. Car accidents, unruly passengers, and verbal harassment are ever-present threats. But many vulnerable drivers say they feel like they are risking their lives each time they slide behind the wheel. According to an April 2023 Strategic Organizing Center report, which was working with the Rideshare Drivers Union about the safety concerns of rideshare drivers, quote, 67% of rideshare drivers respondents reported having experienced some kind of violence, harassment, or threatening behavior in the last year. The attack in Boston is just one of many cautionary tales for rideshare drivers, especially those who are women or people of color. Attackers typically target those who they believe are the most vulnerable. 79% of app-based drivers have felt unsafe, and female drivers experience higher rates of sexual harassment, according to researchers at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Many Lyft and Uber drivers depend on their jobs to provide for their families, and researchers say they often fear that intervening and speaking up may lower their ratings and endanger their jobs. Dwayne Mitchell, the curator of the Massachusetts Drivers United website, says, quote, "When I walk into a union meeting, it's like walking onto the pages of a giant John Steinbeck novel. They're really vulnerable and extremely exploited people, especially since a lot of them don't speak English." Mitchell's prior experience as a Boston cab driver versus an Uber driver illustrates what he says is a stark difference in safety standards. Mitchell says, quote, "I had to take safety classes with training by the Boston police before I could get my cab driver's license. There's a bulletproof partition separating you from the driver in cabs, but Uber doesn't care. There's none of that." Beyond the issue of Uber's lack of safety protocols, Mitchell said there is simultaneously a lack of community within rideshare drivers. As a cabbie, he said there was a sense of togetherness and drivers would alert each other about potential dangers. Quote, "Many of us had an extra radio in our cab just to speak with other drivers. We had two radios going, one for the cab company and the other to speak with each other," he said. "We heard stories all the time and were always aware of the potential danger." Uber doesn't make space for that camaraderie, according to Mitchell, which leads to isolation and fear of self-reporting incidents by drivers. Attacks on rideshare drivers are rare in Boston, he said, but one wrong ride can change people's perception of the risk. Mitchell says, quote, "People are nice all over Boston, but all it takes is one lunatic." Ariel Appleby is a student in the Boston University Journalism Program, and this story was written in partnership between the Boston Sun and the Boston University Journalism Program. And for our next story, City Council hearings identify operational issues within Boston Police Department. This story, written by Karan Rajamani. An analysis of 10 months of Boston City Council hearings reveals that city councilors have repeatedly and consistently raised concerns about overtime spending, staffing levels, crime lab operations, and a discriminatory promotional system at the city's police department. An investigation by Boston University's student newspaper, the Daily Free Press, revealed more than 200 instances of BPD-related concerns expressed during public meetings between January 1, 2024 and October 1, 2025. Nearly 1,000 hours of City Council hearings and committee meetings were reviewed using artificial intelligence. Each instance was manually verified. Boston Police Department did not respond to multiple requests for comment. Overtime spending exceeds budgeted levels. City Councilor Benjamin Weber said BPD overtime spending has exceeded its budget allocation for multiple fiscal years. In 2024, the department blew through its roughly $40 million overtime budget by about $50 million, according to council hearings. Weber said the City Council has oversight of BPD's budget, but does not impose a firm cap on overtime hours because of public safety needs, court requirements, and security needs during special events. Some overtime policies contribute to higher costs, Weber said, including a rule that provides a four-hour minimum overtime payment for certain court appearances, even if officers spend only a short time before a judge. Some officers make $300,000 to $400,000 a year, primarily from overtime, Weber said. Weber added that the overtime rules are governed by collective bargaining agreements negotiated between police unions and the mayor's office, which limit the council's power to rein in spending. City Councilor Ed Flynn said staffing shortages drive overtime spending. At a May 2024 council meeting, police officials said an average of 131 officers leave the force each year, and only 108 are hired, resulting in a net decline. Quote, because of the significant staff shortages, Flynn said, we are forcing police officers to work mandatory overtime, consistently 16-hour days. He said he has raised the issue during multiple budget cycles, citing concerns about officer fatigue and safety. The staffing shortfalls require the department to rely on overtime to maintain patrol coverage, according to statements made during the hearings. Councilors also raised concerns about the operational capacity of the Boston Police Crime Laboratory during hearings in 2024 and 2025. The crime lab connects DNA testing, rape kit analysis, firearms examinations, and other forensic work used in criminal investigations. During an April 2024 committee meeting, Flynn said that the lab failed to test approximately half of all rape kits within the state-mandated 30-day timeframe during fiscal year 2023. Flynn proposed a $1 million budget increase for fiscal year 2025 to fund staffing, fill the director position, as well as purchase updated equipment. While the city council approved the funding, Flynn said at a September 2025 hearing that he has not yet seen measurable improvements. Quote, I am not confident in the Boston Police Crime Lab and their leadership, Flynn said during a hearing, citing the prolonged vacancy and delayed adoption of newer DNA testing methods used by other jurisdictions. Testimony during a January 2025 Government Accountability, Transparency, and Accessibility Committee hearing addressed the history of police promotional exams used statewide, including by BPD. Retired BPD Detective Larry Ellison referenced a 2023 federal court decision that awarded more than $40 million to officers of color across Massachusetts. The court ruled that the exam used to grant promotions systematically penalized Black and Latino officers in violation of state anti-discrimination laws. The court found that the exams relied heavily on multiple-choice testing that did not adequately measure supervisor skills, which produced statistically significant racial disparities. Judges also ruled the state had been aware of the disparities for years and failed to adopt available alternatives. Ellison testified that concerns about retaliation discouraged some officers from reporting inequities and pursuing leadership positions, describing his own experience after becoming president of the Massachusetts Association of Minority Law Enforcement Officers. City Councilor Henry Santana, chair of the Public Safety and Criminal Justice Committee, he said the hearings underscore the importance of council oversight. Santana said in a written statement, quote, oversight isn't about criticism. It's about ensuring that policies, investigations, and practices reflect fairness and integrity. We strengthen public safety when we address issues openly and work towards solutions to protect all residents. Karan Rajamani is a student in the Boston University Journalism Program, and this story is in partnership between the Boston Sun and the Boston University Journalism Program. For our next story, short play penned by Beacon Hill resident Rob Whitney to premiere next month in Newburyport. And this story was written by Dan Murphy. A short play written by Beacon Hill resident Rob Whitney will be among eight works featured in the two-day New Works Festival 2026, which kicks off on Saturday, January 24th at the Firehouse Center for the Arts in Newburyport. Over the past few years, Whitney and his wife, Marcy Axelrad, have regularly attended small theater performances at the nonprofit Firehouse Center, along with Lyric Stage Boston in the Back Bay and Calderwood Hall in Boston's Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum, among other venues. After the couple attended a performance at the Firehouse Center, Whitney went to the organization's website and learned of its upcoming New Works Festival. He decided then to try his hand as a first-time playwright. Via the application procedure, Whitney went online and picked hockey from a number of provided selections as the category for his piece. He began to writing process by dictating it in a stream of consciousness manner before printing the first draft and refining it over time. Whitney submitted the script for his short play called Puck for consideration in the festival around May, but didn't learn it had been selected until around the end of November. The submissions had all been read and were then selected by a group of three judges, none of whom was aware of the identities of the respective authors, according to Whitney. Whitney said, quote, "I was shocked and kind of excited learning that his short play had been chosen for inclusion in the upcoming festival. Puck focuses on a conversation between a father and his hockey-playing son in a basement of a Beacon Hill townhouse." Whitney says, quote, "It's a comedy drama. Something happens and the father and son have a conversation about the son's ability to continue playing hockey." While Whitney himself never played hockey, he played soccer in his youth instead, his son Adam, now an 18-year-old freshman at the University of Tennessee, began playing the game at around age 6 in the North End Youth Hockey at the Strini Skating Rink. Adam continued playing the game through high school, and Whitney admits that much of the dialogue in Puck mirrors conversations he had with his own son over the years. "Some of the dialogue, the funny stuff, is what my son and I talked about," said Whitney. For the upcoming performance, Puck will be directed by Arlene Bernard, with two unidentified actors as the father and son. Keeping in line with the other short-length plays featured in the festival, it's one act and runs about 9.5 minutes long. The same 8 plays in the festival, including Puck, will be staged again at the theater during a matinee festival performance on January 25th. Meanwhile, Whitney, an attorney by profession, is already now at work in his spare time on his next short play, which will focus on a conversation between two people at a downtown Boston coffee shop. In looking ahead, he said he hopes to write a longer play focusing on the courtroom trial. Firehouse Center for the Arts New Works Festival 2026 takes place Friday, January 24th from 7 to 9 p.m. and again on Saturday, January 25th from 2 to 4 p.m. at the Firehouse Center for the Arts, located at 1 Market Square in Newburyport. Tickets are $15 for general admission and can be purchased online via the Firehouse website at firehouse.org. For our next story, MBTA achieves major milestone with the historic Daniels Feingold settlement. This story is special to the Sun. The Massachusetts Bay Transportation Authority, the MBTA, disability advocates, and original plaintiffs of the landmark accessibility lawsuit came together on December 10, 2025 to celebrate an historic milestone in the ongoing effort to make public transportation accessible to all. After 19 years of steady improvements to the accessibility of its system, the MBTA has fulfilled a substantial amount of its obligations under the 2006 Joanne Daniels Feingold versus Massachusetts Bay Transportation Authority settlement agreement. As a result, court-appointed independent monitor Judge Patrick King will conclude his oversight role. In honor of this milestone and to demonstrate its ongoing commitment to advocating accessibility-wide for the system, the MBTA has worked with the original named plaintiffs, the Boston Center for Independent Living, the BCIL, and the Greater Boston Legal Services, GBLS, to enter into the Next Generation Accessibility Agreement with BCIL, which includes numerous commitments related to delivering best-in-class accessible service for all riders. This agreement also shifts oversight responsibility from a court-appointed monitor to the Riders Transportation Access Group, RTAG. RTAG is the MBTA's citizen-led advisory committee on accessibility matters, and the organization will work together to make more progress toward the entire MBTA network. Anyone is welcome to become a member of the group. Quote, "Since my very initial days at the MBTA, it was evident that the plaintiffs in the Daniel Feingold landmark lawsuit were now partners. Their long-term commitment to working with us to improve and advance accessibility was not about the case, but rather ensuring that all who wanted and needed to use mass transportation had the same access as everyone else, something that we at the T value equally. This is why this settlement agreement is not only a major milestone, but so meaningful for myself and the MBTA leadership as we share that goal. While nationally, the MBTA is one of the most accessible legacy systems in the United States today, we also know we have much more to do." That statement there from Interim Secretary and MBTA General Manager Philip Eng. He goes on to say, "I value the dedication shown by each of the plaintiffs, in particular Joanne Daniels Feingold, Marnaris Sapita, Reginald Clark, Thomas Gilbert, Andrew Foreman, along with BCIL led by Bill Henning, Tara Matty Doucette, and the entire team at GBLS, and independent monitor Judge King. I offer my sincerest gratitude for their decades of open communication and partnership as we strive to address accessibility at the MBTA. In addition, I would like to thank Christine Daniels, a community advocate, for her help on this important work. I'm so proud of the System-Wide Accessibility Assistant General Manager, Laura Brelsford, and her entire team's effort that led the progress we see every day. We remain committed to ensuring one day each and every individual can use the MBTA with safety, dignity, and confidence, and will now work with the RTAG, who has now assumed oversight responsibilities. Assistant General Manager of System-Wide Accessibility, Laura Brelsford, said in a statement, quote, "The story of the Daniels-Feingold lawsuit and settlement is one that should be shared far and wide. 2 decades ago, a small group of disabled riders, with help from a dedicated legal services organization, spoke up after experiencing years of inaccessible service. And when no one would listen, they kept fighting, ultimately securing what would be recognized as the most comprehensive accessibility-related settlement agreement in public transportation. What's even more impressive is that once the settlement was signed, they shifted quickly from litigants to partners and have consistently and constructively guided us into becoming one of the most accessible systems in the country today. It has been a privilege to work alongside them and be part of this story." And Joanne Daniels-Feingold said in a statement, quote, "For more than 20 years, the named plaintiffs, Greater Boston Legal Services, and the community have worked with the MBTA to make accessibility improvements that benefit all riders. I'm glad that RTAG will now have the resources and a strong platform to take our legacy into the future." And another one of those plaintiffs, Myronis Mick Cepeda, says, "It marks a huge step toward ensuring equal rights for riders of all abilities." Reginald Clark said, "I'm glad that we were able to bring the right people at the MBTA together with the community to solve the access problems. Now it's up to the community to keep the work going with RTAG." Thomas Gilbert said, quote, "It means we have come a really long way compared to 20 years ago. It's far better than it was. We've made a real difference, not just with the MBTA, but worldwide. The MBTA has become a benchmark standard for accessibility." And Andrew Foreman said, quote, "Thanks to the leadership and foundational work of Greater Boston Legal Services and the plaintiffs, and with the strong team we have assembled, including System-Wide Accessibility, the Boston Center for Independent Living, and the Riders Transportation Access Group, I am confident that we will continue to advance accessibility at the MBTA. Although the transition presents significant challenges, our productive working relationship with the MBTA gives me confidence that full accessibility will ultimately be achieved." Gene Smith said, quote, "Today, I am very pleased to see the MBTA transformation from a decrepit system to one that is finally accessible, dependable, and built for all riders." And another statement here says, quote, "BCIL extols the amazing individual plaintiffs who've given over 20 years of personal time to improve accessibility at the T, the great Greater Boston Legal System legal team, and the ongoing commitment throughout the MBTA's ranks to get it right on the ADA." That statement there from Bill Henning, the director of the organizational plaintiff, Boston Center for Independent Living. Another statement here from Tara Maddie Doucette Esquire, who serves as lead counsel for the plaintiffs on behalf of the Greater Boston Legal Services, quote, "Now that plaintiffs will be transitioning to RTAG, it is important to note that the work is not done." She goes on to say that accessibility is not a box we check. It is a standard we must continue to raise. As systems age, as ridership grows, and as new technologies emerge, the community via the Boston Center for Independent Living and the Riders Transportation Access Group must insist that progress continues steadily, boldly, and with inclusivity. Another statement here, "On behalf of the Riders Access Transportation Group, I am honored to accept the baton of responsibility from the Daniels-Feingold plaintiffs, who have worked tirelessly for over 2 decades to improve MBTA access for everyone." That statement from RTAG facilitator and community organizer, Kat Torres-Radzik, who went on to say that "our commitment will extend beyond the settlement as we continue to promote transparency, equitable, and inclusive service delivery, and build public trust in the MBTA." Since the settlement agreement was reached in 2006, the MBTA has made sweeping improvements to virtually every aspect of its fixed route system in order to ensure riders with disabilities have access to safe and reliable service. Upgrades have included creating and growing the Department of System-Wide Accessibility, a clearinghouse of accessibility expertise, prioritizing elevator maintenance. In the early 2000s, many of the MBTA's most frequently used elevators were out of service the majority of the time. Today, elevators on average are operational 99.4% of the time. Additionally, a new elevator standard was created, resulting in larger, more transparent elevators. Also, transitioning to an entirely low-floor, ramp-equipped bus fleet, fully revising and refreshing trainings for frontline employees on how to provide best-in-class accessible service, restructuring the process for handling accessibility-related complaints to ensure a fully closed-loop system, expanding outreach and engagement to older adults and people with disabilities throughout the MBTA's Mobility Center, developing and administrating an internal accessibility monitoring program in order to systematically evaluate the experience of riders with disabilities, significantly expanding station accessibility. In 2005, less than 60% of stations were accessible. Today, 83% are. 93% of stations are projected to be accessible in the next 5 years. Advancing dual-mode public information systems so that important information is broadcast audibly as well as visually. Rolling out new wayfinding signage standards to make sure that navigating the system is easier. And although not part of the Daniels Feingold settlement, the ride has seen a number of improvements in recent years, including improved on-time performance, as well as a new rider-facing app. Numerous accessibility improvements are planned for the coming years, including major accessibility upgrades at over 30 stations, advancing the automatic enforcement of blocked bus stops using bus camera technology, issuing a first-of-its-kind accessibility training for transit police officers. A full list of the ongoing initiatives, visit mbta.com/accessibility-initiatives and check out mbta.com/accessibility for additional information. For more information, connect with the MBTA on X, formerly known as Twitter, at MBTA, on Facebook at facebook.com/the MBTA, Instagram at the MBTA, Threads at the MBTA, and TikTok at the MBTA. The Massachusetts Transportation Authority, the MBTA, opened America's first subway tunnel in 1897. This has been Mike with the Talking Information Center reading the Boston Sun, again dated today, December 19th, 2025. Thank you for listening.